I'd like to thank Karen Gelman and the organizers for inviting me to talk. I'd like to call your attention to my website URL there. I will have these slides there, and a lot of times I also, we have reprints and technical reports and actually some interactive software for planning both phase two as well as phase three targeted clinical trials. So I invite you to browse that website. Now I'm going to actually, I think, be talking a little bit about both phase one and phase two. I view them somewhat together, particularly for targeted agents. And I think basically what we do in phase one and phase two is try to figure out what we're going to do in phase three and whether we're going to do anything with the drug in phase three. For phase one, I think today for targeted agents, the objectives are basically to develop a dose schedule to carry forward and to determine whether the drug inhibits the targeted pathway. Ideally, we would have a drug and a target so specific for cancer cells that the drug can be delivered repeatedly at doses that completely shut down the deregulated pathway without toxicity to normal cells. For the most part, that's not what we have because the current targets are not specific to cancer cells. Most targeted drugs are toxic. And I think there's also a reluctance a lot of times to select the drug that really targets just a single gene product. A lot of times you see people preferring, for example, drugs that have effects against multiple kinases. I think it's sort of, from their point of view, an insurance policy that you might have the mechanism, you know, that's driving particular tumors wrong. And it's difficult to know what pathways are deregulated in particular tumors in a patient. However, when you do that, you probably invite normal tissue toxicity. And so consequently, we're, for the most part, dealing with drugs, even in molecularly targeted era, that are limited by dose-limiting toxicity. So also, I think part of something to consider is that there are relatively few examples of drugs, very few examples, I would say, of cancer drugs whose effectiveness at inhibiting the target decreases with increasing dose after some maximum. And there's lots of drugs for which the effectiveness plateaus, and we a lot of times talk as if the effectiveness can decrease, but I don't really think there are very many examples where that's the case. And so titrating the dose for maximum inhibition of a target makes nice talk, but I think in fact, in reality, it's very difficult to do because of assay variability and the need for tumor biopsies and knowing what the right assay is also. And knowing whether the mechanism of action is really what you think it is. And consequently, I think that's a very difficult sort of approach. And when you combine that with the fact that there's really not much reason to believe that the anti-target effect is going to decrease above, if you go too high. And when you combine that with the fact that the drug probably is toxic anyway and has, if you want to give the drug over a long period of time, you're going to be limited in the dose you can deliver. I think the appeal of titrating dose to some maximum inhibition of target loses its attractiveness. Titrating dose to a plasma concentration at which the target is inhibited in some preclinical model is much more feasible. So I think in many cases, determining a dose just below the MTD, which can be delivered repeatedly, is often the most appropriate and practical approach. And then once that dose is determined, accruing some additional cohort of patients at that dose and then trying to use the assays that you think are the appropriate assays to determine whether at that dose the target is inhibited, I think leads to a practical approach to phase one trials in many situations of molecularly targeted agents. The objectives of phase two trials of targeted agents are listed here, in my view. One is to determine whether there is a population of patients for whom the drug demonstrates sufficient anti-tumor activity to warrant a phase three trial. Secondly, to sort of optimize the regimen in which the drug will be used in the phase three trial. Will it be used alone? Will it be used with some standard chemotherapy for that kind of population of patient, or how will it be used? And third, to optimize the target population for the phase three trial. And I'll be talking actually quite a bit more about that as the talk goes along. The endpoints for phase two are the traditional endpoints. We sometimes use tumor shrinkage. Those are in many ways the easiest endpoints, the easiest kind of endpoint to use, because we can pretty much evaluate on an individual patient whether we're getting shrinkage, and for the most part tumors don't shrink on their own, and so if we're getting enough shrinkage we can attribute it to a drug effect. And usually, and a second possible endpoint would be inhibition of target pathway. That's usually something we might rather do during phase one to see whether we're having some effect. The more we have to sort of tell whether we're inhibiting the pathway, the more biopsies we have to do, unless we're dealing with leukemia, and the sort of more difficult the trial becomes. And thirdly, if we're dealing with a situation where we think the drug may be cytostatic instead of cytotoxic, we may want to use a time to progression endpoint, or the proportion of patients without progression at some specific time. If the latter is the case, that leads to more complicated kind of phase two designs, because how can we really infer whether a drug has caused a increase in time to progression? That kind of endpoint requires some kind of comparison, and we either need to have whether we're dealing with time to progression or proportion without progression at some point in time. There's some kind of comparison implied. And we either have to then talk about using some kind of a historical previous data to know what, for those kinds of patients, what proportion would have been expected to be without progression at that point in time, and to sort of base our interpretation on that, or to do some kind of a randomized phase two design. I've previously, in a paper a few years ago dealing with vaccines, introduced what we called a phase two and a half design, and subsequently another paper by Ed Korn and some others discussed the same kind of approach. The idea is you have a randomization, say, between chemotherapy alone or standard chemotherapy with your new drug. Your endpoint is progression-free survival. Regardless of whether progression-free survival is sort of considered a surrogate for survival or a adequate measure of patient benefit for that disease, because this is a phase two trial, you're just at this point trying to determine whether you're having anti-tumor effect. And the idea with the phase two is that, well, you're able to use progression-free survival. You don't have to worry about whether that's going to be an adequate endpoint for approval, regulatory approval. And the third thing is you're not necessarily tied to a two-sided 0.05 significance level. You can use something less stringent than that, since this is really just a situation of telling you whether you want to go on to a phase three trial. And so you can get by then, consequently, with a somewhat smaller sample size. These are total number of samples, number of patients in the two arms, is a function of what kind of an improvement you're targeting, and what the alpha level for is the basis for defining the power is. So I don't want to take the time to go through this. Like I say, I will have these slides on my website. I think ASCO also has them already on its website, and they are in the ASCO education room. But the point is, you can get you can get by with fewer patients than with a phase 3 trial, but it's still more patients generally than if you were going to do a traditional single arm phase 2 trial using objective response. The other proposal that has been made is called randomized discontinuation design, where you start with all patients being given the drug. The patients with early progression go off study. Patients with early objective response continue on the drug. And the patients who neither have early progression nor early objective response then get randomized either to discontinue the drug or to continue on the drug. And you measure progression-free survival from the time of randomization. This can facilitate observing an effect of the drug on progression-free survival compared to a standard randomized phase 2.5 design, because you're sort of excluding those who are progressing so fast that they won't respond to the drug. It does still require actually quite large sample size, and it's not a phase 3 trial because it doesn't establish the clinical utility of administering the drug to the patient compared to not administering it. It really just is a kind of phase 2 design, and because it looks randomized like the randomized phase 2.5 design, sometimes people are mistaking it for a phase 3 design, which it's really not. So conducting a phase 3 trial, okay, now I'm going to switch a little bit to talk about optimizing the patient population, something we would like to do in phase 2 to gather this information in phase 2 so that we know how to really do the phase 3 trial in patients who are most likely to benefit from the drug. So conducting a phase 3 trial in a traditional way with tumors of a specified site stage pretreatment category in many cases I think results in erroneous conclusions, one of two kinds of erroneous conclusions. One is it can give a false negative trial. Unless a sufficiently large proportion of the patients have tumors that are driven by the targeted pathway, then you may get and if you do sort of just a broad phase 3 trial, you may get a negative result and a false negative. You could get a positive result in a situation where actually a relatively small proportion of patients benefit from the drug, but they benefit by such a substantial amount that they cause an overall difference in outcome. So you wind up with the drug approved or the drug widely used, even though it really only benefits a relatively small proportion of the patients. And I think in general, in cancer, in oncology, we do an awful lot of treating the majority for the benefit of the minority. If you just think of your average, say, breast cancer adjuvant study, say, of node-negative women, where maybe 90% are going to be cured by surgery alone, and then we wind up treating all of them to get an increment of 3 or 4% in survival or disease-free survival. You're treating a lot of people to benefit relatively few people. Ideally, you'd like to be able to characterize, before you get to a phase 3 trial, you'd like to characterize what patients are most likely to benefit from the drug so that in the phase 3 trial you can really test specific hypotheses about that. So if you wind up doing that kind of analysis in the phase 3 trial, then you really need to do additional phase 3 trials to test those hypotheses. There's sort of a principle here that I don't think I've put on a slide, and that is that the key principle is that you have to, the data used for developing the classifier of who's likely to benefit from any kind of a genomic or biomarker classifier of what subset of patients benefit, the data used for developing that needs to be separate from the data used for testing a hypothesis. So with new drug development, you'd like to be able to be developing those kinds of hypotheses in phase two studies. So this, I think of the kinds of, I call them classifiers, and these coming in sort of two general categories. One is single gene or single protein based class biomarkers based on the knowledge of the therapeutic target. For example, HER2 expression or HER2 amplification, EGFR mutation or EGFR amplification. These single gene, single protein things based on the target of the drug. In situations where you don't have that, then sort of empirically determined, usually multi-gene classifiers, in many cases gene expression based classifiers, based on correlating gene expression, or could even be genotype, to patient outcome after treatment. You have responders, you have non-responders, you have a genome-wide scan of expression for the responders and for the non-responders, and you figure out empirically just a mathematical classifier that distinguishes the responders from the non-responders. And very often it's actually much easier to develop a classifier which works very accurately than it is to figure out what those genes are telling you about the pathogenesis of the disease. Figuring out what those genes are telling you about the pathogenesis of the disease is usually an endless process. Developing a classifier that permits you to accurately predict who's going to respond and who's not is a much more straightforward operation. And then the other thing is, when do you develop such a classifier? Well, either using your phase one and phase two data, which usually you're not going to have enough of, but that, you know, you could, or after a phase three trial, or potentially after a broad indication drug approval, when you then try to do that. The single gene or protein-based classifier based on knowledge of the clinical target, often there'll be several assays that can be used. Should you use mutation? Should you use amplification? Should you just use an immunohistochemistry assay of protein expression? And phase two development is a good time to establish which assay should be used in phase three. The assay used for either selecting patients for phase three or for testing hypotheses in the phase three trial should be determined, ideally, before starting the phase three trial. Refining the target based on single gene or protein assay to use in phase three can be either accomplished from a single traditional, single-arm phase two trials with response endpoint, or from randomized trials, randomized phase two trials with a progression-free survival endpoint. This is the guiding principle I was mentioning previously, to separate the studies in which you're developing your hypotheses, in which you're developing your classifiers, from the studies in which treatment effectiveness claims are to be based, should be definitive hypothesis testing studies based on completely pre-specified classifiers. What you don't want to be doing is what we often currently do, and that is we do a phase three trial, we then look for what genes are associated with outcome, we wind up with a bunch of them, and now we say, and now that has to be tested in further trials. Easier said than done. It's better to come up with these classifiers as early as possible. And now I'll say a little bit about how you go about testing hypotheses using them in phase three. One approach is to you develop some kind of a predictor of who's going to respond to your new drug, and then you restrict eligibility to your phase three trial based on that classifier. The patient's predicted to be responsive, they get randomized in your, say, your phase three trial. If they're predicted not to be responsive, because they don't express the target, for example, you wouldn't study them in a phase three trial. If you have a lot of confidence in your target and your assay, then this may be a viable approach. This was the approach essentially for Herceptin, in metastatic breast cancer. There was a classifier that was not a very good classifier, but it was good enough to do targeted study with Herceptin in patients that got the drug approved. I published a couple of papers with one of my postdocs in which we evaluated the efficiency of that targeted design, phase 3 design, compared to the design where you just take all comers. And we evaluated it in the context of where you don't have a perfect assay. And and we found that in many cases you can have tremendous improvements in efficiency from using that kind of a targeted design. I don't really need to finish up here. The alternative, of course, is that you very often you will not want to exclude patients based on the classifier you have not full confidence in, but you want to at least plan. Have a pre-specified analysis plan, and I'll just sort of go through this. You don't use it to restrict eligibility, but you structure a prospectively planned analysis strategy of the trial. And the strategy I'm proposing here is you compare the new drug to the control overall for all patients, ignoring the classifier, but you use a threshold of 0.04 instead of 0.05 for that test. And if the overall test is not significant at the 0.04 level, then you perform a single subset analysis evaluating the new drug in the classifier-positive patients, and you consider that significant based on a more stringent threshold level of 0.01. So the two tests add up to your traditional 0.05 protection, and it also gives the sponsor a encouragement to be developing these kinds of classifiers with some assurance that if their drug is more broadly eligible, effective, it won't hurt them in terms of narrowed labeling or in terms of increased size of phase 3 trials. Going to have to, I think, basically skip a lot of this. Did want to say that basically just that if the phase 2 trial, well, I think I'll have to skip some of this. Did want to summarize. Phase 1 trials of molecularly targeted agents should generally be based on determining a dose that can be delivered repeatedly over time with acceptable toxicity, and then evaluating whether the targeted pathway is inhibited at that dose. Phase 2 trials are most efficient if anti-tumor effect can be evaluated in individual patients rather than use of progression-free survival. Phase 2 trials should include establishment and refinement of classifiers of which tumors are most likely to respond, and such classifiers should be completely specified prior to launching the Phase 3 trials if possible. Phase 3 trials should include prospectively specified plans for the utilization of these classifiers to predict which patients have the sensitive tumors.
Thank you. Maybe we have time for one question now, and then we'll try to have some questions at the end. And just to mention, there are a number of seats up front if people want to talk. So, question there, please.
Rick, very nice presentation. I have only one particular question regarding the genomic classifier for the 0.04 or 0.01. The question is that, how do you solve the problem that this particular subgroup is not randomized any longer? So there are some non-prognostic factors that may be responsible for the significant difference between in the genomic classifier.
You're not comparing outcomes for one subgroup versus outcomes for the other subgroup. You're just evaluating your treatment versus your control in that either overall or in the subgroup. And so there, since even within the subgroup, you have randomization of which patients were assigned the new treatment, which patients were assigned the control. If it looks like there's some imbalance with regard to some prognostic factor, you could adjust for that in the analysis. But there should be no systematic reason why you'd expect any imbalance.
So you don't think that the ones that has this particular factor may be any imbalance of
anomaly? Oh, the ones that have a particular, that have the genomic, say, classifier positive may be very different than those that are classifier negative, but you're not doing that comparison. You're doing two comparisons. One, treatment, new treatment versus control treatment overall for all patients. Secondly, new treatment versus control treatment for the subset. So you're never comparing.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I know there'll be more questions. We'll try to get to the end or after the session. So I now have to call on